Okay, so welcome back again. We will continue where we left off last time. We're just having a look at this concept of avijja at the very beginning of the dependent arising. And we have had a look at what that means in practice, and specifically what the meaning of the Four Noble Truths, because as I mentioned before, it is the lack of understanding the Four Noble Truths which is the definition here of avijja, of not understanding, of not knowing. So this obviously is then a very important part, because this stands at the very beginning of the sequence which eventually leads to suffering here. So now we want to have a look at how this avijja fits in with other aspects of dependent arising, how it is itself conditioned, and also how it conditions other phenomena, and how this conditioning process works, right? And this is actually, I don't know, I always found it's quite interesting. It's not perhaps entirely obvious straight away how it works, but once you see it, it's actually quite, I think it's quite useful, and something you can take into your practice once you start to understand this. So, the next sutta here is actually called Ignorance, avijja, and it talks about the how it arises. Bhikkhus, it is said a first point of craving for existence, bhikkhus, is not seen such that before this there was no craving for existence, and afterward it came into being. Still, craving for existence is said to have a specific condition. So here we are talking about craving for existence, first of all. And why is craving for existence singled out in this way? Remember, we were just talking about the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Three types of craving: sensual craving, craving for existence, craving for extermination, it has here, or annihilation, or non-existence, or whatever. And of course, of these three cravings, it is craving for existence which is the most fundamental one. You can give up craving for sensual pleasures, it's, you know, at least for a while, or even for long periods of time. Craving for to be exterminated is not that common. It's craving for existence is the one that is most fundamental to most people. We want to exist, we want to continue on, we want to live here, we want to keep on going into the future. I think this is why it is singled out in this way, because if we can deal with this craving, then everything else also tends to kind of fall into place. And it says here that there is no such thing. You cannot say that there is any beginning to this, right? It just goes on and on and on. Back in time, there's no first point of this craving for existence. Similar thing to what I think I mentioned this yesterday as well. And there are other suttas where the Buddha says that there is no first point of beings roaming around, traveling around, transmigrating in samsara. There's no first point to that. You can go back in time. You can remember your past lives. The Buddha is supposed to have remembered 91 eons or something of past lives. And even then, there was no beginning to this. There was just more roaming around, traveling around. Like this word roam, right? This kind of aimlessness that is roaming around in the forest, moving from A to B, from C to D, not really knowing where you're going, having no destiny, no aim, no purpose. This random movement through this samsara, this life to life, randomly moving around, roaming around. It's kind of a very, I think, like an evocative word. It evokes this feeling of, what are we doing here? This is not, it's kind of aimless and pointless thing here. And so there's no first point to all these beings or anyone roaming around in samsara. And craving for existence as well has no first point. And there's something powerful about that teaching. This because one of the interesting things about this particular phrase is that when it later on was translated into Tibetan, I think it was, instead of being said that there was no first point can be discovered, no first point can be seen, right? No matter how far back you go, you cannot see a first point. In the Tibetan translation, it becomes, there is no beginning. There is no beginning to craving for existence. And there is an enormous difference between making the statement there is no beginning, and to say that no beginning can be discovered. One is a statement of what you can actually see for yourself. I can't discover a beginning, you can see that. But when you say that there is no beginning, you're making a statement which goes way beyond what can actually be seen. And you're making a statement which is more like philosophical, more like a statement which is more speculative, right? You're speculating really about things. And this is the beautiful thing about the Buddha, the way he teaches, the way he looks at the world. It's not really speculative, it's all based on his personal experience. And if he makes some kind of inference, if he says something more than what is immediately experienceable, it is based on inferences, on what can actually be said as a consequence from experience. And this is so powerful, and he doesn't overstate his case, right? This is what he does here. He says exactly what he has seen. I have seen this. And it doesn't say it goes infinitely into the past. But you can see it's very easy to read this as if it has always been like this. It goes back to infinity. So you can see how if a translator gets it slightly wrong, the translation into a different language will actually be faulty. But there's something very reassuring about that the Buddha, he says exactly what he sees, and he doesn't draw conclusions that cannot be drawn from what he has observed. So no such beginning is seen, and I think that is a nice little thing. There's a great honesty in a sense about this. So there is no beginning to craving for existence, right? You have always craved for existence, always going on. But even though there is no beginning to it, it is seen to have a specific condition. In other words, there are things which drive the craving for existence. And of course, the fact that it has a specific condition is what enables us to make an end of it, right? If we figure out that actually it's not really worthwhile keeping on experiencing all this stuff, it's not really worthwhile keeping existing, it's not really worthwhile roaming around in samsara aimlessly here and there, suffering here, now suffering there, right? Or different kind of suffering, very interesting. This suffering is more interesting than the other suffering here. But after a while you think, okay, enough of all this interesting suffering here. Now it's time to get out of suffering instead. So it's like having, you know, oh, now we're going to have Chinese food, we're going to French cuisine, right? Different flavors of suffering is a kind similar kind of idea. So what then is the specific condition? This is what the next thing is about. I say because that craving for existence has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for craving for existence? It should be said, ignorance, avidya. We have just seen ignorance, right? So avidya is the reason why we crave for existence. We think that existence is worthwhile. We think that we can achieve happiness. We think that this is really useful. And there is a purpose to all of this, right? There is a purpose in the universe, so we want to keep on existing here. So ignorance itself, the fact that we don't see clearly, that's why we want to keep on existing here. And then it says, ignorance too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for ignorance? It should be said, the five hindrances. So, and this is why I wanted to read out this little paragraph here. It's part of a very much longer sutta, and it's actually a very nice and interesting sutta, and it is included later on in this large number of suttas here, and hopefully we will get to that sutta. I didn't really calculate how many suttas we're going to be able to do on this retreat, so it's a bit random if we're going to be able to go through everything or not, but it is included here, so hopefully we can have a look at it later on. But this interesting idea that it is the five hindrances that are the nutriment, it says nutriment here, to ignorance. And what that means is that as long as you have the hindrance in mind, ignorance, avidya, this delusion, lack of understanding, is going to be nourished by the nutriment of the hindrances. So the more hindrances you have in the mind, the more ill will you have, the more craving you have, the more tiredness you have, the more restlessness you have, the more doubt you have, the more you have all of these things, the more confused you're going to be about reality, the less clarity you're going to have, the greater is going to be your misunderstanding of how things actually work. And as a consequence, you're going to do all kind of silly stuff because of that. So remember that. Every time you're reducing the hindrances, you're actually seeing more clearly. And you know that's true, right? It's very clear that that must be the case. If the hindrances drop down, you know that when you have less ill will, you have less anger, you have less of these things, you gain a sense of clarity, right? You know that that is the case. And you actually feel that you can see things more clearly. But the point here is that to be able to see 100% with clarity, you have to remove the five hindrances completely. And this is what is so difficult. It is easy maybe to reduce them a little bit, but to take them, abandon them completely, actually is very hard, because these things are very deep-seated in us, especially the hindrance of craving for sensual pleasures is very deep-seated, and there are very refined, very, very refined aspects to this, right? Very kind of, you sit in meditation and you want to just move because you're feeling slightly restless or whatever, and that tiny bit of restlessness is likely to be rooted in sensual desire in one way or another. Not really fully content, right? It's like something is missing here. What is it that's missing at the time? Maybe there's not enough happiness there. Your mind slightly wants to move towards sensual desire. You can barely notice what is going on. But that restlessness is driven by something like that. So this is very, very deep-seated, and it has to be overcome completely before you can undermine avidya. But once it is overcome completely, then avidya, this delusion, lack of understanding, it doesn't have any supports anymore. It doesn't have any pillars, nothing to support it. So at that point, it is weak. And the only thing which is upholding it at that point is your wrong view, your lack of clarity about things. But at that point, if you keep on observing, you can overturn that wrong view, and it's possible to acquire the right seeing of reality. So it's very important to have an open mind about things, right? When you come to that point, finally, and you're seeing avidya, ignorance is undermined, if you already have very strong established ideas, yes, there is a creator God who created me, right? If you already have that view, then it may not be possible to see things according to reality, because you have already decided what that reality is like. So you have to be very open at that point and not have any preconceived ideas. Otherwise, you're going to read the wrong things into your experiences. You're going to get into a jhana state and say, yes, I have discovered God, right? But maybe it isn't God, maybe it's something else, maybe it's just an experience. You don't know. You have to have an open mind at that stage. And it's very easy to understand why the hindrances are so supportive of ignorance. It is not really difficult to understand, right? And you can, a very simple way to understand this is that if you, when you get angry with somebody, your view about what is appropriate to do at that time is very different from when you're not angry. When you're angry, you think, yeah, I need to tell them off, right? I need to do whatever. I need to do these things. Or at least I need to think about them in a bad way. But when you're not angry with that person, your outlook is very different. You don't need to tell them off. You don't need to think about them in a bad way. You have compassion instead. Your view is very different when you're not angry. And when you compare the two, you know that when you are calm and reasonable and you are at ease and relaxed, that is the view, you know, which is straight. That is the time you actually see things in the right way. Later on, you regret it. If you did something bad while you were angry, you regret that, right? You think, wow, why did I do that? That was stupid. It's just going to cause more problems in the future. They will not be happy. You know, you never get your own way when you get angry. People only get defensive if you get angry with them. Much better to kind of persuade them in a calm and reasonable fashion. They may not get it, but that's irrelevant. At least you're optimizing your possibilities. So you know that when it comes down to it, that mind state when you're angry, it is deluded. It is has no base in reality. The same thing with desire, right? When we have strong desires, we do all kinds of crazy things. You know, you if you are committed to a partner, that's when you have extramarital affairs, when you kind of go out and you want to buy something, you do all this impulse shopping that later on you think, gee, why did I buy that for? That was an absolutely silly thing here. But at the moment, it seems like a good idea because you're overcome by desire for something. You see that nice Ferrari on the street, right? Oh, I got to get myself a Ferrari. So, sometimes, you know, even as a monk, you can see a Ferrari and think, wow, that's a nice car, right? It's hard to avoid that feeling sometimes. But not that I want a Ferrari, by the way, it's just that. But it's, you know, you can see that there. And of course, when you eventually get that Ferrari, you have it for a while and you think, big deal, right? But when you see it, it looks kind of really, looks very attractive and very worthwhile of having in your possession. All of these things, they delude us. You can see how the hindrances are really problematic. And when you're tired, when the mind is cloudy, right? Of course, you can't see anything clearly. Very obvious when you have stop and torpor. If you are restless, the same kind of thing. When you're restless, the mind is kind of slitting back and forth, moving back and forth. There's no steadiness. You can't focus on anything for a sustained period of time, right? And if you can't do that, you can't see it for what it really is. Any knowledge, understanding, create needs sustained attention. If you want to understand something in a textbook, if you want to read something, study something, if you want to read the suttas, some degree of sustained attention is required to be able to take on board what is going on. So restlessness is obviously bad. Doubt, the last one, obviously bad. Doubt in the suttas, in the context of the five hindrances, means doubt in regard to what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. You don't know which qualities are good, which are bad. You think, yeah, what's wrong with desire, right? Desire is good. That's what gives my life meaning. If I don't have any desire, jeepers, life would be terrible. I'd just be sitting there like a sack of potatoes, not doing anything here. And, of course, that is no good. So desire is important. Desire is wholesome. You know, pursue your desires. So you don't really know what is good and what is unwholesome, what is wholesome. And this is one of the things that we are trying to uncover on the Buddhist path, to fully understand which qualities are truly wholesome, which are truly unwholesome, which actually really make you happy, and which just have the appearance of making you happy. There's a difference there. True happiness is very different from what is often the appearance of happiness. And this is what doubt is about. You don't really know, what am I supposed to do next? Which, you know, you sitting in your meditation, is this thought good or bad? Is it leading in the right direction or the wrong direction? And sometimes we're not sure, because things get very refined. We are in territory we have never been before. Hindrances are so refined, we don't know. We have never actually been here before. Or maybe we have, but maybe it was many lifetimes ago or something. So, this is how you can see how these defilements, the five hindrances, underpin ignorance, underpin the lack of understanding. And only when they are absolutely 100% removed is it possible for you to see things clearly in accordance with reality. The yatha bhuta jnanadasana. Only then is it possible. So it's easy to see how the hindrances distort the mind when they are very strong, but there's a little bit of distortion there, even when they are weak. And only when they're completely abandoned is it possible to see things clearly. In fact, it is even more than complete abandoning is required. It is also required that the mind becomes very steady and stable. And this is why samadhi and things like the jhanas are so important, because it stabilizes the mind. It gives us the strength and the ability to stay with things for a long period of time. And that strength is required when you're going to uncover some truths that may shock you, right? Some of these truths, they may be true, but it may be kind of shocking, at least initially. And once you see them, of course, they make you very happy. But initially, precisely because we are deluded, the uncovering of delusion can sometimes be difficult. The uncovering of non-reality, the uncovering of what seemed to be true can be hard. Sometimes people tell you something, right? You don't want to hear it. But perhaps it's true what they say here. Perhaps it is for your benefit. The Buddha comes along, your teacher comes along and says, well, you have a problem here. No, I don't have a problem. I'm all right. But wait a minute, maybe you're right. Maybe I do have a problem here. Uncovering of truth can always be difficult, and it's easy to become defensive because of that. So you need a strong mind to be able to take it. And that is why Samma Samadhi, the jhanas, are so important at this stage. So this is how you uncover this. This is why it is so important to abandon the hindrances. The path of purification, so much of the Noble Eightfold Path, is just about overcoming the unwholesome aspects of our conduct, of our mental states, and all of this. And then when you get to that point, when it's all gone, then, whoa, now perhaps I can see reality for what it is. Okay, so this is the nutriment for ignorance. And remember that the stronger the hindrances are, the more ignorant you are, the more delusion you have, right? So when you feel that the hindrances inside of you, you feel they are strong, be very careful what you do. The best thing often is not to do very much at all. If you feel angry about something, often it's best just to be quiet and kind of go for a walk or something and see if you can overcome that anger before you say anything or do anything. Because it's very hard to do the right thing when you are in the grip of these unwholesome states of mind. Okay, so that is the conditioning ignorance of avidya. Very important to realize that. And of course, once you know that the five hindrances are the problem, then you can go back and you can ask, well, what is the cause of the five hindrances? You look to the cause, and that's what I'm going to do later on. And then you find the cause of that. And then you find what is the cause of that again. And you bring it back to the very basis, the very basic things. And the ultimate cause of all of the problems. This is kind of interesting, right? What is the ultimate cause of all these problems? Why is it that we can't get rid of the five hindrances so we can get rid of ignorance, avidya? What is the ultimate cause here? I'll show you later on. But the ultimate cause in this particular sutta, the final cause is not hearing the word of wise people, not hearing the word of the Buddha, not seeing the Buddha, right? Not having kalyanamittas. Kalyanamittas, by definition, are those people who enable you to see clearly, who put you in the right direction and move you forward on the path. And of course, number one kalyanamitta is the Buddha. He is number one. So that is the ultimate cause. Once you start to hear the word of the Buddha, it's like your mind gets a sense of direction. You start heading in the right way. Right? This is the 100% of the holy life, as it says in the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya 15. Okay. Anyway, now, so that is avidya. Now I want to look at how avidya conditions in the other direction. Now we have looked at the cause of avidya or the nutriment of avidya. Now I want to look at where avidya takes us. Where does this delusion, this ignorance take us? If you're ignorant, what happens next? So now we're going to go back to dependent arising again. And just to remind you, this is just the same thing we were looking at before. And as it says here, ignorance or delusion is the condition for willed activities. The willed activities are the condition for consciousness, right? The three first aspects of dependent arising here. And then you have the reverse. So if the ignorance fades away, but with the remainderless fading away and cessation of avidya, of delusion, comes the cessation of the willed activities of the mind. And with the cessation of the willed activities of the mind comes the cessation of consciousness. So we want to look at both sides of this equation, both how things arise and also how they cease. So we understand the whole process here. Before I do that, I will also just read very briefly the next sutta here. The next sutta gives us a definition of these things. We have already seen the definition of ignorance, and here is the definition of these willed activities, and also the definition of consciousness. It's not all that interesting, because it doesn't really explain these things in a kind of very detailed way, but let's just have a look at it very quickly anyway. And what, bhikkhus, are these willed activities of the mind? There are these three kinds of willed activities. Willed activities of the body, willed activities of speech, and then willed activities of the mind. These are called the willed activities. And what bhikkhus is consciousness? There are these six types or kinds or classes of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. This is called consciousness. So the purpose of these definitions is just to make sure that we have a comprehensive view of these things. What these definitions are saying really is that all willed activities, every possible willed activity is included within the idea of willed activity independent arising. Every willed activity, the only activities we do is either in the mind, it comes out through our mouth, or it is through the bodily activities. There is nothing apart from that. That includes everything here. So when we talk about willed activities, independent origination, we mean everything, the whole gamut of willed activities. And the same thing, the definition of consciousness here is not all that exciting, right? The different six classes of consciousness, but it shows us that all kinds of consciousness are included within dependent arising. There is no consciousness outside of this. There is no consciousness apart from the seeing. We experience things by sight, we experience things by ear, we experience things through smell or odors, right? We experience things by taste, by bodily touch, and finally by mind, by the imaginative faculty of the mind. So all consciousness is included. That's really all it means. They're not very informative, these particular definitions here as such. Anyway, so now we want to look at this connection between avidya and sankhara. Sankhara is the word here for what is here translated as volitional formations, what I call willed activities. And as I was saying yesterday, this idea of sankhara, just to get an idea what it actually means, it is derived from the word which is karoti in Pali. Karoti means to do or means to act. And sang, this idea of sang in front of it, sankhara, sang karoti. Sang means like together. So it's something like putting together. Right? That's what it means. Putting together something, creating something, producing something. This is the basic idea of sankhara. So these are what you might call the creative activities of the mind. We do things. We want to create stuff, right? We want to make things. We want to ensure our future. We want to, whatever it is that we want to make, comes from the will inside. The will is the driving force that wants to create and make things in the world. So these are these creative forces of the mind, creative activities. And it comes out in body and speech, and it also comes out purely in terms of mental phenomena as well. Purely the willing of the mind is also included in this. So this is the basic meaning of this, right? So once there is ignorance, we start to create. That is what this is saying here. Once there is delusion, all this creative activity starts. Why is it? What is the connection here? How come delusion leads to all this creative activity here? Now, to see this clearly, it is important that we understand. We have already been looking at delusion. We have been saying that it means the lack of understanding of the Four Noble Truths, right? Now, the first noble truth is the noble truth about dukkha, suffering. It means that we don't really understand dukkha. We don't understand dukkha. We don't understand sukha. Sukha and dukkha, we don't really, happiness and suffering, we don't really understand them. We don't understand where they are to be found. We don't really have a clue. That's why the Buddha has to spell it out, right? These are the Four Noble Truths. If we already knew, it wouldn't be any point in spelling it out. So we don't really understand this. And very often we think that happiness is to be found. We're actually suffering is to be found. We think that what seems like suffering, actually it turns out to be happiness. So often we have a completely inverse relationship with reality. We think that if I get angry, I will get things sorted out, right? And all you're doing is creating havoc and problems for yourself. You think if I desire a lot, wow, I create a great future. Actually, you're causing problems for yourself as well. So one of the biggest problems with Avidya is the lack of understanding of where true happiness is to be found and where suffering is to be found. But because we think we know where happiness is, that is why we start to try to create that happiness in the future. We want to produce it, right? Oh, I'm going to find a nice relationship, right? So I'm going to go out and find a nice relationship in the world. I'm going to build myself a nice house. I'm going to have a good job. I'm going to even practice the Buddhist teachings, right? Even that is kind of part of that. I'm not saying it's wrong to practice the Buddhist teachings. That would be terrible if I said that, wouldn't it? It would be one of these kind of moles, you know, from outside who has been kind of infiltrated into Buddhism, trying to destroy it from the inside. Of course not. That's not the point. The point is just that because we don't understand happiness and suffering fully, when we come to Buddhism, we are coming to with a slightly wrong idea of what actually is happening here. We are heading in the right direction, but it's not 100% the right direction. And gradually, as we practice this, we start to get more clarity about what is going on here. So, but anyway, everything we do, all our creative activities is driven by this idea that we understand where happiness is to be found, where suffering is to be avoided. And then we go out into the world, we go out into our lives and try to create that happiness. Avidya, paccaya, sankhara, delusion is the condition for the creative activities of the mind by body, speech and mind. This is how it works. Now, another aspect here of this avidya that we have is the sense of being in charge of things, is the sense of self that we have inside of us. We feel that we have the power to make these things happen, right? This is a very important aspect of the sense of self, is the feeling that we are the doer. I am the doer. I am the actor. I have the power to effect these things. I can go out and find the right partner, right? Find the wrong person, I will reject them, and I will only take the person who is right for me. And we feel that we have the power to affect happiness for ourselves. And this is this delusion of self inside of us, the feeling that we have much more power than we actually have. In the end, we don't have that much power. Okay, we may find a partner, they may turn out to be very different from what we thought, they may divorce us, they may die, we may die. All of these things can happen. But we forget that in the process, and we think that we have power to get something which actually we don't have the power to have at all. These things are so much more uncertain than what we think. And of course, these two things combined, right? The idea that you think you know where happiness is, and you have the power to get that happiness because you are the doer. It's a very powerful combination. Combination means that you will, by default, go out and seek that happiness for yourself. Even now, even when you hear this, you may think there is some truth to that, but still, you know, you will still keep on doing it because it's a very deeply ingrained habit. So this is how it works. And then, based on that, you start doing things. So, to give you an example of how this works, right? You go out and obviously one of the most important things in life is to kind of, you know, for most people we need to have some kind of partner in life, right, to get married or whatever. So you go out and you seek a partner, and then if somebody, and if you do it in the right way, it is a positive thing, you do it with the right intentions and you kind of create a certain amount of happiness for yourself and also the other person, but sometimes it goes wrong, right? And somebody else gets in the way. Somebody else is also interested in the person that you are interested in. Then you get angry. And then maybe you do unwholesome things because you are competing for the same person in a sense. Right? It's very obvious when it comes to kind of relationships. But it's also true in a more mundane way. It's true at work. We compete for the same positions, perhaps for the same salaries. And sometimes we do unwholesome things in this pursuit of our own happiness. So once we start pursuing happiness in this way, we do wholesome activities and we do unwholesome activities in that pursuit, right? And this is the nature of pursuing that happiness, that we have to do both unwholesome things and wholesome things as a consequence of that. But the interesting thing here, what really matters here, and this is what I was talking about very briefly yesterday as well, when you do unwholesome things in the pursuit of the happiness, when you do bad things, you have to be the owner of that bad actions you do. You have to take responsibility. Remember, I'm just saying here that you think that you are the doer. You think that you are the agent in your life. You identify as that agent. So when you act, when you do things that are unwholesome, you have to own that unwholesome action. You did that, right? That's what you think. That's what it feels like. You did that bad action. So because you are the owner of the action, it means that when you do that, you will feel bad about yourself, at least to some extent, because you have to take responsibility. And this is how this works, right? You cannot avoid some degree of remorse, some degree of dragging yourself down, of lowering yourself, of limiting yourself. Every time you do something bad, even if you just have a bad thought, that already will drag you down to some extent, let alone if you actually do something bad in the world. That is, of course, much worse. So this is what the sense of self does. Sometimes we are taught in the Buddhist teaching, yeah, you just forgive yourself, right? And when you forgive yourself, you can kind of carry on. And of course, there is some truth to that. Forgiving oneself is, of course, very important. And the way to forgive yourself is to understand how conditioned you are as a person. You're not really fully in charge, right? All these external influences, internal influences are acting upon you. And because of that, you are not really fully in control of yourself. But the problem is that because of the sense of self, you will never be able to forgive yourself 100%. There will be a residue inside of you which says you are actually responsible for this. And to the extent that there is a residue left, to that extent you will judge yourself. And you will drag yourself down and you will feel bad about the bad things that you have done. And I would recommend you to investigate this, because this is quite easy to actually see in your own life. If you look at your own life, you just look at every time you do anything which isn't quite right, every time you think a thought which isn't nice, right, isn't a good kind of thought, and almost everybody occasionally thinks thoughts that aren't nice. What happens when you think something which isn't nice? And what happens very often, you can see, if you look into your mind, you see there's a loss of energy there. There's a loss of brightness. There's a loss of mindfulness. There's a loss of happiness and joy which you might otherwise have. You feel that you are dragging yourself down. You're pulling yourself down because of that unwholesome state of mind. Right? If you say something which isn't nice, see what happens inside of you. If you do an act which isn't right, how does it affect the mind? And if you are observe yourself very carefully, you will see it actually is dragging you down. And that is a concern, right? It's worrisome. Imagine if you do this again and again and again. The more you do that, the more you drag yourself down, and the worse it becomes, and the lower is your level of consciousness. And this is why consciousness here is conditioned by these willed activities that we have. Your mind, consciousness here is really just a word for the mind. Your mind is dragged down as a consequence of all these actions. Why? Because you own them. I did it. So you get lowered down in this way. And so you start to understand the urgency of doing what is good, right? Of avoiding doing these bad things. Because the person you are really hurting is just yourself. Maybe you're hurting the other person. That's kind of irrelevant. Here, it is you're looking at yourself, understanding how badly it affects yourself every time you do something which isn't quite right. And of course, the opposite is what happens when you do something good. Because the good actions you do also, you're also the owner of those as well. So every time you do something good, I did the good, right? I did that good action. Hooray! And you feel happy about yourself because you did something good. And notice that inside of you. Notice what happens in your mind when you do something truly kind to somebody else. You just give something to somebody. You say something nice. You have a nice thought about somebody, right? And you see straight away that it's as if your mind, your consciousness is lifted up. Right? Hooray! You know, I did something kind to somebody else. You feel good about yourself. Your consciousness is lifted up. And when you see that, you see the power of kindness, the power of goodness for yourself and obviously for other people as well. It is very, very powerful, and it lifts you up. And of course, all of this, this is what we mean by kamma, right? It's very important to understand that this is exactly what kamma is all about. Kamma, sometimes in popular Buddhism, kamma is about, yeah, you're kind in this life and you get a Mercedes in the next life or whatever. But, I mean, there may be some truth to that. I don't want to say that that is absolutely wrong. There may be some truth to that because, yeah, you know, there will be happy results and it may lead to riches and all these kind of things. But it is kind of irrelevant, right? What is really relevant when we are practicing the path is the immediate karmic results that we have here and now. They're called the ditta dhamma kamma, the kamma that is experienced in this very life. This is what really matters, and this is what we can observe, right? You can actually feel this for yourself, and you can actually understand, start to understand the laws of karma through direct experience while you do this. And then the accumulation of karma means if you accumulate a lot of good actions that lift your consciousness up, and you accumulate few bad actions which depress your mind, then of course the a balance sheet will be a positive one and you will have lifted yourself up, right? So the accumulation of all these willed activities, they have the effect, the cumulative effect of either lifting up your mind or depressing your mind down or leaving your mind roughly on the same level. So our job on this path is to do so as many good acts as we possibly can, to do as few bad acts as we possibly can, and then gradually lift up our mind, lift up our consciousness, so that we feel more happiness, more lightness, more goodness in our lives. And this will then enable our meditation practice, will cause our happiness, and also cause the happiness for the people around us. So there you can see this beautiful sequence, how avidya or vidya leads to activities. Activities, you have to take ownership. It affects your mind directly. You can see the sequence, the first three factors of dependent origination, how they work together in this way. So this is essentially what is going on here and how this whole sequence then works out. So if you can then bring it back, if you like, even further, you can bring it back to the sensual desires that lie before ignorance, right? So if you have a lot of sensual desire, then your activities will tend to be based around sensual desires. So your willed activities will be based around that. And because they are based around that, your consciousness, your mind will be stuck on that particular level, right? Will be stuck in the sensual realm. That is where your consciousness will be stuck. And you can see that. What do you think about? What are you attached to? Just know yourself. One of the great things about coming on a retreat like this is to be able to know yourself quite well. Where does your mind tend to hang out? What is your mind interested in? What are you thinking about, right? You know yourself, you know where the mind is stuck. You know roughly the level of your own mind. You know what is going on inside of you. And then you can tell. And of course, for most people in the world, a lot of their obsessions and thinking will be around sensuality in a very broad way. Attachments, all of these kind of things. You know your mind is there. So that is where mind will tend, right? The mind will have this tendency towards that. It's like this is the purpose, the aim in life. So this is what you are projecting yourself into the future in this way. Right? So because that is your aim, because that is your aim in this life, you are aiming towards sensuality. When you die, you're still aiming for sensuality. So that aiming carries on. You're aiming for that into the future. And for that reason, you get reborn. The mind continues in that. When you die, the body falls away, but the mind continues in that existence. That is what we mean by rebirth then in the sensual realm, because the mind is aiming for these things. And of course, then if you have done a lot of angry acts or a lot of bad acts of greed while you lived, then even though the mind is aiming for the sensual realm, because you have dragged it down by doing unwholesome activity, etc., it will go to a sensual realm, but not to a nice sensual realm, a bad one, because your mind actually feels a bit yucky, right? You feel bad about yourself. You judge yourself in a bad way. So because of that, you go to a sensual realm, but perhaps not a nice one. I don't know, you know, like being reborn as a ghost, you know, a ghost or an animal or something like that. So which probably isn't that nice. Or maybe as a human being, but not such a nice rebirth. But then if your mind is aiming to the sensual realm, but you have done it in a good way, you have lived a good and pure life, then perhaps you can get reborn as a human being or in the Devaloka or something like that as a consequence. So these two things come together. What you are aiming at, the mind is aiming at something. This is called the chetana. This is the will aiming at something together with the accumulated karma. Those two things together decide where you then get reborn. And of course, if you change that aim, right, you come a lot here to the Janagar Retreat Center, you practice the Buddhist path in a good way, you can see that over time, your mind changes its aim. It is not so engrossed anymore in sensual things. It becomes more interested in the pure happinesses of the mind, the things that we do in meditation practice. There's a gradual shift there. This is not about judging anything. It's just about understanding that there is different types of happinesses, some more refined and profound than others. So your mind gradually, slowly shifts over time. Your interest is somewhere else. And eventually, all your interest is found in samadhi, in deep states of meditation, because it's very easy to know that these things are much more profound and meaningful than all other kinds of happinesses. So when you die, right, you do all the activities based on that, and then when you die, your consciousness is based on that level. Because you've been practicing samadhi in this life, when you die, you're still aiming for that samadhi. And because you have accumulated the kamma which is behind it, and here the kamma is just simply practicing the samadhi, and of course doing all the good acts that come with that. And then your mind heads in that direction when you die, because you're already at that level, you're aiming for that, you are there. You die, the mind just continues in that existence. So you can see here how this whole thing works, and how your mind is settled at a certain level, depending on the aims of the mind and all of these kind of things. So this is how ignorance conditions volitional formations, right? You think that you are in charge and you think you know where happiness is, and then you create all these things and you have to take responsibility for them as a consequence. The next sutta is a sutta, maybe we can go through this one fairly quickly, it might be good. And this is just an example of all the things that I've been talking about now. This sutta is called volition, in other words, the will, the doer inside. Let's have just a quick look at this sutta, because it really just summarizes the things that I've been talking about now. So this is at Savati. Because what one intends, what one plans, and what one has a tendency towards, this becomes the basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is a basis, there is a support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is established and has come to growth, there is an inclination. When there is an inclination, there is coming and going. When there is coming and going, there is passing away and being reborn. When there is passing away and being reborn, future birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Right? This is one of those statements that when you first read it, you have no idea what is going on. It's really kind of, whoa, this is weird stuff. I remember when I first read some of these sutras, I thought, well, what on earth is going on here? But after you start to contemplate dependent arising a little bit, because this is part of dependent arising origination sutras, you can start to see what is happening here, right? So very at the beginning here, you have this idea, what you intend and what you plan and what you have a tendency towards, this becomes the basis for the maintenance of consciousness. And that is exactly what I have been talking about now, right? We intend Most people intend sensuality, sensual pleasures. You plan for sensual pleasures, and you have a tendency, an underlying tendency for sensuality. This is what most people's life is about. So intending here just means that you will, this is what you are willing. You want to go in that direction. You're planning for this. And even if you're not actually actively intending or planning anything, there is inside of you an underlying, these are called the underlying tendencies, whereby the mind has that tendency inside of it, even though they're not activated at any particular point. And because this is the tendency of the mind, and because this is the volitions and your will, this is what you are interested in, that is where your consciousness is, right? Your mind is there. These are the things you're thinking about. That is what it means for your mind to be at a certain level, as I was just talking about before. So your consciousness is maintained at that point. And because it is maintained there, that becomes a basis and a support. Your consciousness is established at that level. If you practice meditation or samadhi, your consciousness is established at the higher level because that's what you're interested in. That's what the mind inclines towards. That is what it is. It intends towards, right? So the mind is established at a different level. So look, have a check out your own mind and find out roughly where you are established. And of course, where the mind is established because you keep on intending, it's as if you are affirming that level of consciousness. You keep on doing it again and again. You're strengthening the karma of that plane, right? This is what it means. Consciousness comes to growth. You're strengthening the karma by doing it again and again. And there is inclination. The mind is inclining towards this. The mind is aiming for this. The consciousness is looking for the future to have more of these things. So when you die, the aim is still there. And you're projecting that mind into the future for more experience of sensual pleasures. And that's why it says that when there is an inclination, there is coming and going. And when there's coming and going, there is passing away and being reborn. I'm not sure exactly what the difference is between coming and going and passing away and being reborn. Perhaps the difference is that one includes the intermediate existence that happens between lives, whereas being reborn means actually entering into a new life. That is one possibility, but I'm not entirely sure what is meant by that. It's not really explained anywhere in the suttas as far as I know. It is kind of assumed that people know, but it doesn't really matter. It is all part of this process, right? So because there is an inclination of the mind, that is where the mind hangs out in the intermediate existence, and then eventually you get reborn accordingly, in accordance with that. And then because there is all this passing away and being reborn, basically you continue on, right? You get reborn in the future, and because of that there is old age and death, and there is all this process of samsara going on and on. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering here. If because one does not intend and one does not plan, but one still has a tendency towards something, like sensual pleasures, this becomes the basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is the basis, there is a support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is established and has come to growth, there is inclination. When there is inclination, there is coming and going. When there is coming and going, there is passing away and being reborn. When there's passing away and being reborn, future birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering here. So even if you don't plan anything in particular, even if you don't intend anything, the underlying tendency of your consciousness will have a certain level depending on the past karma. It will still carry on according to that because of the underlying tendencies. And you can know, again, you know those underlying tendencies by seeing where your consciousness tends to hang out. What is it interested in? What is its attachments? What are its desires that always tend to come back? The kind of the basic habits of the mind, if you like. This is what the tendencies are. But then you have the opposite, right? And this is the cessation mode, which I should have spoken about before, which I forgot, so it's good that I'm getting reminded of that now. But because when one does not intend, does not plan, and one does not have a tendency towards anything, yeah, there is no basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is no basis, there is no support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is unestablished and does not come to growth, there is no inclination. When there is no inclination, there is no coming and going. When there is no coming and going, there is no passing away and being reborn. When there is no passing away and being reborn, future birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Right, this is the cessation mode. One day you penetrate through avidya, through ignorance, through delusion. We're seeing this before. You penetrate through that and you see that actually happiness and suffering are to be found in a very different place than where you thought they are to be found. They are to be found in the ending of sensual pleasures. They are to be found in the ending of existence. That is where real happiness is to be found. And of course, if real happiness is to be found in the ending of existence and experience, in the ending of sensual pleasures, then you are no longer intending for that. You're no longer interested in that. You're no longer looking to the future for happiness. Happiness is in the present moment, right here and now, because existence itself is not desirable. You don't have any desires for the future anymore. And because you have no desires for the future, because you're not actually intending anything in the future, your consciousness is not established in any of those realms. You don't want to be reborn in the sensual realm. You don't even want to be reborn in the jhana realms. You don't want to be reborn in the immaterial jhana realms. You don't want to be reborn anywhere. So your consciousness, your will, is not projecting onto anything in the future. It is not established in anything in this life because it isn't holding on to anything. It isn't attached to anything. So consciousness is free from all of these things, free of all the attachments, all the holding ons. It is not at any level anymore. It is beyond all this leveling business, outside of that. And because of that, there is no inclination for the future. No projection into the future. And because of that, when you die, instead of consciousness then moving on into a new existence, because it isn't projected into the future, not holding on to anything, instead of moving into the future, it stops instead at that point and doesn't actually go anywhere. So this means that consciousness itself, the mind itself, stops at that point because it's not interested in anything. But as long as you are interested in being reborn, you will be reborn. If you have no interest anymore, it will stop by itself. So there's nothing to really worry about, right? If you want to be reborn, it's going to happen. If you don't want to be reborn, well, then it won't happen. So it's not something, oh, wait a minute, this is dangerous. I don't want to be stopped like that. Okay, well, if that's the case, it won't happen. So you're okay. So you don't have to be too concerned about those things. It's good, right? There's like a safety mechanism there. So you don't have to be too concerned about what's happening here. So that is roughly how that goes. This is very profound stuff, right? Very deep, some of these things. But the main point about this, which I think is of immense practical value, is to understand how your will, how your doing activity inside, how it conditions your mind. Try to understand that. Feel how whenever you think something bad or you do something which isn't quite right, feel how it conditions your mind, how it kind of drags you down. Look at what doing the good things do to you. See how they lift you up, right? You do something kind, you feel uplifted, you feel glad inside as a consequence. Understand that. And the more you understand that, the more motivation you will have, the more intention, the more stronger will be your intention to act accordingly. It's a very powerful motivation to do the right thing here. And it becomes kind of worrying to do what is bad, right? So you don't do that so much anymore. This is the main thing, the main practical outcome of this. So dependent arising is practical, right? So practical, so useful. It's not just kind of this dry theory or dry intellectual exercise. It's full of practical advice. And this is what is so useful and wonderful about this. But who would have thought that from avidya, paccaya, sankhara, sankhara, paccaya, vijnana, you can draw out so much amazing information. I wouldn't have thought that 10 years ago or 20 years ago when I started out in monastic life. It takes a long time to really get to grips with the implications of some of this. And of course, many of the things that I will say you, I am not saying that I am probing the full depth of dependent arising at all, because it is very profound. The Buddha says as much. But at least I'm trying to draw out some of the implications of this. There is obviously still much more in these teachings, which makes it kind of exciting, right? It's kind of a source, endless source of liberating insight and of wisdom, which is wonderful. Okay, so that is enough for this afternoon. So I will see you again this evening at 7:30.